has won the popular vote by almost 3 million votes and received more votes than any other person has ever received in the history of our country for president of the United States.
We're going to have to leave it there, but of course we'll report on what takes place. Polly Baca, thanks so much for joining us, an elector from Colorado. That's it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Give to KBOO today during our end-of-year match. Wrapping up December 31st, donations from all new and increasing members will be matched one-to-one up to $15,000 from the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Give an extra gift today or become a new member, and your membership will be doubled to support independent community media and citizen journalism at KBOO. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee, third Wednesday of each month at 5 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kboo.org.
The time is 5 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, Portland's neighborhood theater since 1924. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, and salads. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, LaurelhurstTheater.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Trump wins the Electoral College.
Paul Free will go free along with 152 others after President Barack Obama's latest round of clemency decisions.
And a Seattle artist's racial reparations project is connecting the lived experience of people of color with white people prepared to leverage their privilege to directly assist them. We speak to reparations founder Natasha Marin.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 19, 2016. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Donald Trump's win in the presidential election last month was made official today. Members of the Electoral College met in state capitals around the nation to cast their votes for president. They were met by protesters in several states who urged the electors to vote for anyone but Trump. Most electors voted for the candidate who carried their state, yet there were a few who voted for alternatives. A minimum of 270 electoral votes were required to win, and a total of 306 electors were expected to vote for Trump. In the end, only two of Trump's electors, both representing Texas, broke ranks and chose other candidates. One voted for Ohio Governor John Kasich, the other for former Texas Congressman Ron Paul. In addition, four of Washington State's 12 electors who had been expected to cast their votes for Hillary Clinton instead voted for alternative candidates. Three voted for Colin Powell, while the fourth voted for Faith Spotted Eagle, a Native American elder from South Dakota. Electors in Maine were forced to hold a second vote after the first was nullified when an elector switched his vote from Clinton to Bernie Sanders, which was ruled out of order. In the second vote in Maine, that elector switched back to Clinton, while two of the other electors switched their vote to Trump. The inauguration takes place at noon on January 20th.
Many Americans remain shocked that Hillary Clinton lost, having trusted the polls that showed her in the lead. But Donald Trump voters who chatted with Columbia journalism student John Alsup recently on Staten Island and in rural Wisconsin were not surprised he won. Time and again, Alsup was told that pollsters were agents of a conspiratorial liberal media and that Trump voters were scared to tell them the truth when they were spoken to at all. He asked Reuters head of polling Maurice Taman and stats expert Professor Andrew Gelman on how the polling industry can move forward in the face of this yawning credibility gap.
It's fair to say that most of the media did not see Donald Trump's election victory coming.
The biggest political shocker in American history.
An astounding upset victory.
Against all predictions, denying every poll.
You're awake, by the way. You're not having a terrible, terrible dream.
Also, for Columbia University professor Andrew Gelman, their shock reflected a wider pre-election consensus.
I think that most people thought Clinton was going to win the election because people were getting data from a common source.
That common source? Opinion polls. Almost all of them showed Hillary Clinton in the lead right up to Election Day. Across America, however, some people just didn't believe the poll's predictions. At all. Maurice Taman, a pollster and data journalist at Reuters in New York, thinks that most Trump voters always believed their man would win, despite the polls.
If I go out in Times Square and ask people who they thought was going to win, yes, I think you would almost have universal acceptance that they expected Hillary Clinton to win. But if you went to rural Indiana, for example, I don't think you would get the same sentiment.
I set out to see if he was right. Well, I didn't go to Times Square or rural Indiana, but I did go to Brooklyn.
And who did you expect to win the last election?
I expected Hillary Clinton to win.
Hillary Clinton.
I expected Hillary to win.
Hillary.
And why?
Because I had faith in America.
And you voted for her?
I think it's pretty obvious.
And then I went to Brooklyn, Wisconsin. Population, 1,401. Same spelling. Sadly, the bar in town was closed because the owners were in Vegas. So I carried on down the road to the Union Tavern, where locals played slot machines, a refrigerator unit heaved with meat and cheese, and a pint of Spotted Cow beer set me back less than a buck. And as Taman sort of predicted, it wasn't hard to find Trump voters who didn't trust the opinion polls. Like Tyler Payne, a 21-year-old marine technician.
I know, say on a 100 people scale that I know, three of them were going to vote for Hillary.
So Union is in Rock County, which actually did vote for Clinton, as did neighboring Greene and Dane counties. But pollsters were shocked that Wisconsin as a whole went for Trump, the first time the state has voted for a Republican presidential candidate in 32 years. And Payne feels the polls totally missed people like him.
Everyone thinks that Hillary was going to win. Well, where do those polls come from? They come from people who are on social media all the time, you know. It's not people who are working 40 hours a week, 40 to 70 hours a week, and coming to a bar after work because they're
very
tired, you know. And then they sit here, have a beer, and go home, feed their family, you know. It comes from all the hippies like yourself. You know what I mean, though. I mean, that's where they're taking all these polls from. That's why it was only 30% Donald Trump or whatever.
Now, some Trump voters I met in Wisconsin did trust the polls. This is Tyler Payne's friend Jake Conant, also 21.
I thought Hillary was going to win.
And why did you think Hillary was going to win?
That's what all the polls showed. I mean, I did kind of believe that. I kind of believed when Trump was saying that everything was rigged, but I did believe Hillary was going to win.
And as for those Trump voters who didn't, well, it isn't necessarily unusual to believe that the candidate you like will win, in the face of polls that say that they won't. As Professor Gelman back at Columbia explains, it's an established theory, with a name and everything.
Confirmation bias is that you have a belief about the world when you see evidence that seems consistent with that belief.
Yeah, okay, this is basically what this sounds like in real life.
Who did you vote for in the election?
Trump.
And who did you think was going to win?
Trump.
Hey, jump!
I'm now in the main tap in Oregon, Wisconsin. It's Chubb's twice-monthly meat raffle, and I'm talking to Leo, who wouldn't give his second name. He's never believed opinion polls.
Because they're all for Democrats. It's always been like that since I've been knee-high to a grasshopper.
But something still seems different about people like Leo's mistrust of the polls in 2016. Something he said really struck me.
You go to California, you get beat up if you say you're a Trump fan. They're beating them up.
You get beat up if you say you're a Trump fan. Leo said that twice during our interview. And back in New York, the idea that Trump voters were scared to tell pollsters the truth about their choice cropped up too. I went to Staten Island, which voted Trump, and spoke to the Reform Party's Richard Luthman. He's an unashamed Trump fan. But
you have a lot of the mainstream media and the people thinking, well, if you support Trump, you're a deplorable. And so I think a lot of people just kept their mouths shut.
And this is important, because not only did many Trump voters feel that polls didn't reflect them or their vote, they also didn't trust the media that was writing about them. Luthman took me to meet Sam Pirozzolo, a local Republican who had a giant Trump T on his lawn burned down earlier this year. He's a character. Pirozzolo. Could you spell that?
Yes, I can.
Could you spell it for me?
Oh, please? Would you like me? Only kidding.
Pirozzolo said something I heard a lot from Trump supporters, that polls were part of an overarching liberal media campaign to get Clinton elected.
I think that the polls and the pollsters were busy listening to their own hyperbole, and they sunk their own ship. And they would sway the polls to show a favoritism to Clinton in any possible way that they could.
Taman, the Reuters journalist and pollster, strongly rejects the idea that the numbers were biased.
I really genuinely believe that is, could not be further from the truth. You know, our model, for example, is barely touched by humans. And ultimately, what I would say is that no matter what happens, once the election is decided, all polls are judged on how well they predicted the outcome.
He says the media is at least partially to blame for presenting opinion polls badly.
I am not going to cast blame on readers and consumers of the media for misinterpreting something that we perhaps have poorly communicated. I can't do that. That's not fair. You know, statistics are devilishly difficult. And I don't expect our readers to even to have that type of expertise.
Taman thinks the media should be clearer in communicating margins of error and the difference between polls based on the nationwide popular vote and state-by-state polling. But would extra clarity bring back trust in polls? On Staten Island, Pirozzolo thinks that
they are not to be trusted going forward, right? I think polling is a dying issue. They have to find other ways to do these polls.
And back in Union, Wisconsin, I asked Jake Conant, the Trump voter who actually believed polls saying Clinton would win.
Do you still trust them? I mean, would you trust them again?
Probably not. I mean, I did know this election was going to be extremely close, but I'd probably be more hesitant now at this point, yeah.
By and large, pollsters got 2016 wrong, but they've been wrong before. Difference in a hyper-partisan climate where what the media reports is so often seen as being on one side or another is that the very assumption on which polling rests is being called into question. As Taman says,
if you don't accept that, the premise that we operate from a place of neutrality, then I don't know how you fix that problem.
Polling companies face a credibility deficit and seem unable to predict how it might affect their future. Oh, and I should mention that none of the polling I did for this piece was scientific, but hopefully it wasn't part of a liberal conspiracy either. Reporting from New York City and from Union, Wisconsin, I'm John Alsop.
Wednesday of this week is the winter solstice. KBOO producer John Shuck, whose podcast Beloved Community covers issues of religion and spirituality, is hosting a solstice celebration at his church tomorrow night. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with John about why it's important.
This week is going to be the winter solstice, the longest night of the year, in a really difficult year. John Shuck, can you talk a little bit about what is the solstice and why does it matter that we observe it?
Well, the solstice is obviously, we know, when the longest night and the shortest day, and it's a time to observe because it's been observed by human beings for as long as they've just gazed at the stars. And this dark time, of course, we're talking in the northern hemisphere, and then the light is to come. And so it's a time also of acknowledging the dark, and that can be the literal physical dark, but also the dark aspects emotionally, or the dark times politically even, and to recognize that the sun will come again, return again, and make the days longer. And so we think of all of the celebrations that we have, like, for example, Christmas. Really, before Christmas and before all of that was the solstice. And so this is kind of going back to our roots.
What will you be doing in your congregation to observe this event?
Well, we are having a longest night service on Tuesday night, the 20th, and it's an opportunity for people to light a candle, to recognize or honor grief. Oftentimes this season also has kind of a lot of pressure to be happy and jolly and merry, and it's a very difficult emotional season, especially for those who've gone through a loss. And so it'll be an opportunity for people to acknowledge the loss, and we'll hear some good tunes. I've got Jethro Tull lined up with Solstice Song, and we won't be here live, but music like that. And so it'll be an opportunity for poetry and some music and to light candles.
Where can people find out more online about your event coming up?
Our website, www.southmin.org.
John Shuck, KBOO volunteer and spiritual leader in the community, thanks for taking a minute to talk with us about this event.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned at 6 for Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, presenting a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and challenging the status quo. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, rain. The rain could be heavy at times, low around 43 degrees. Tomorrow, rain before 10 a.m., then showers likely, mainly between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m., high near 49 degrees. Today in history, in 1907, a coal mine explosion in Jacobs Creek, Pennsylvania, killed 239 workers. Only one miner in the deep mine at the time survived. In 1946, in Hanoi, 30,000 Vietnamese nationalists under the command of Ho Chi Minh launched their first large-scale attack against the French, beginning an 8-year struggle known as the First Indochina War. The quote of the day is from the late folk singer Utah Phillips, who said, "The state can't give you freedom, and the state can't take it away. You're born with it, like your eyes, like your ears. Freedom is something you assume. Then you wait for someone to try to take it away. The degree to which you resist is the degree to which you are free."
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. 8,000 New York, New Jersey airport workers are voting this week to ratify a brand new union contract as members of 32BJ SEIU. This victory came after 5 years of organizing struggle. Rob Hill is vice president of 32BJ SEIU and directs organizing for the union.
The approach we took was different than what people would see in normal bargaining because these are subcontracted. The history of these workers is these were once good full-time jobs, and then the airlines contracted them out, and then by forcing contractors to bid against each other, they've lowered the wages because each contractor undercuts the other. And so the approach we took is that, you know, the way we want to raise wages is to get the port authorities, in this case the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, and government to raise the wage for those workers and set a standard that everybody has to bid equally on. And at the same time, we want to protect all that in the contract, which is what we did.
Hill says this is significant for workers all over America because it shows what's still possible with a strong movement of workers.
It shows that the fight for 15 has caught on, and 20 million people have received raises as a result of that fight, and we encourage more people who are working at low-end jobs to get involved in it. And now we're showing that you can also win the union. And the union helps win the wages, but it's also a way to protect your job, to have a voice on the job, to be able to address issues of health and safety, a whole host of issues that workers normally have no voice on. They now have a voice because they have a contract.
Just days before the November election, the National Labor Relations Board ordered Trump Hotel Las Vegas to stop breaking labor law and negotiate with workers who voted to join the Culinary Workers Union. Culinary Workers spokesperson Bethany Kahn, speaking on WBAI's Building Bridges program, says the president-elect continues to disrespect both his workers and federal law by refusing to bargain with those hotel workers. The Culinary Workers Union is calling for a boycott of all Trump hotels and golf courses.
The workers are fighting for fair wages, job security, good health benefits, and the president-elect, his company pays his employees $3 less than other union workers in Las Vegas. They want a contract. We're never going to stop fighting, and every day we're going to get stronger. There's going to be protests and rallies. And actually, the Culinary Union has called for a national boycott of hotels and golf courses and businesses that do business with Mr. Trump.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 725,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
Brought to you by unionjobs.com, posting jobs for unions, socially allied, and community organizations since 1997.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Justice Department announced today that President Obama has commuted the sentences of more people who were given unduly harsh prison terms due to federal mandatory sentencing laws. Today, the president commuted the sentences of 153 people, most of whom had been convicted on drug charges. One of those who will be set free is Paul Free, a Californian who was sentenced in 1995 to life in prison on marijuana charges. Over the course of two terms in office, President Obama has issued 1,178 commutations. President Obama also issued 78 pardons today, more than doubling the total number of pardons he's issued. The president has also denied more than 14,000 commutation petitions and more than 1,600 petitions for a pardon. There are more than 13,000 commutation petitions still awaiting a decision from the president, including the petition to set free Leonard Peltier. President Obama has the power to continue using commutations until he leaves office next month.
Russia's ambassador to Turkey, Andrei Karlov, was assassinated earlier today while appearing at an event in an art gallery in Turkey's capital, Ankara. He was shot in the back by a 22-year-old active-duty police officer who also wounded several others. The gunman was then killed in a shootout with police. Relations between Turkey and Russia have been strained of late due to the conflict in Syria. The foreign ministers of Russia, Turkey, and Iran are scheduled to meet tomorrow in Moscow to discuss the Syrian war.
A truck crashed into a Christmas market in Berlin today, killing 9 people and injuring up to 50 others, according to German police. The incident occurred on Monday evening, Berlin time. Police said they have taken one suspect into custody and that a passenger in the truck had died in the crash. A police spokesperson told German media the act appeared to be deliberate. One witness said the truck drove into the market going about 40 miles per hour and showed no signs of slowing down. Police said the truck had a Polish registration and belonged to a Polish delivery company. The company said they'd lost touch with the driver several hours before the crash. The Christmas market is located outside Berlin's Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial Church. The church, which is a popular tourist site, was bombed during the Second World War and left in its ruined state as a memorial to the victims of the war.
Why are the Chinese so concerned about that underwater drone? All that and more as we review The Week in Water by HTO Radio.
Speedo diplomacy. That and other stories on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
Last week, the Chinese Navy seized a U.S. underwater drone near the Philippines. The first press reports about the seizure made it sound like the U.S. was involved in a high school science project.
After hearing initial reports, one wondered why the Chinese would be so concerned about a 6-foot-long drone that seemed simply to be testing water temperature and salt content.
According to the Wall Street Journal, the drones do more than harmless research. They track foreign submarines and help underwater navigation. The salinity and temperature data are important in sonar detection.
Beijing urged the U.S. to stop carrying out the reconnaissance missions in what the Chinese consider to be their waters.
China's access to deeper areas of the Pacific Ocean is not as easy as one might think. The country is effectively blocked by neighboring island nations.
The whole incident reflects growing tensions between Washington and Beijing over the South China Sea.
Water wonks and others gathered last week at the Colorado River Water Users Association meeting in Las Vegas.
For months prior to the conference, officials from California, Arizona, and Nevada have been attempting to reach agreement on how to reduce Colorado River usage.
The states want to address what happens if the current drought becomes more severe, because it is not clear legally who would get how much if water levels fall more, and everyone wants to avoid litigation.
As reported by former journalist, now author John Fleck, it was learned at the conference that there will not be a deal among lower basin states before the inauguration.
A sticking point in reaching a deal is what to do about the drying Salton Sea. Farmers in the Imperial Valley Water District want a solution because as that large lake loses water, dust blowing from its bed will threaten crops and pose a serious health risk.
Meanwhile, there was another development last week on the Colorado River. Current Interior Secretary Sally Jewell signed an agreement allowing the Bureau of Reclamation to manage Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Powell for another 20 years.
The dam and reservoir behind it have attracted criticism because water seeps into the ground due to the porous sandstone underneath.
On the other side of the controversy, Representative Rob Bishop, a Republican from Utah, says the agreement favors fish protection over hydropower users.
At year's end, it's common to reflect about the important people who passed away during the preceding 12 months, like actor Gene Wilder and musician David Bowie.
But we're also remembering the passing of the Arctic we used to know, that is.
NOAA released its annual Arctic report card last week, and the grades are not good.
Jeremy Mathis, director of the Arctic Research Program, said in a news conference that 2016 was unlike any other year seen before.
The Arctic has continued to warm at twice the rate of the planet as a whole, and the past year reinforced that trend.
The warm temperatures are contributing to extremely low sea ice levels. At the end of the summer, the ice was half of what it was 30 years ago.
As temperatures rise, the normally frozen ground or permafrost thaws, which releases much carbon and methane into the atmosphere, warming the climate even further.
Meanwhile, at the other pole, a man jumped into the icy waters off Antarctica on purpose.
Lewis Pugh is an ardent activist working to raise awareness about protecting marine life. He set out to swim 5 kilometers to promote his campaign for the creation of 3 marine parks to prevent overfishing.
He reported that 200 meters in, he ran into trouble as he felt his tongue beginning to freeze.
He was able to swim just under 1 kilometer and was in the water for 17.5 minutes.
The seemingly cold-blooded Pugh has been doing what he calls speedo diplomacy because all he wears is his swimsuit and a cap. He's already played an important role earlier this year in the creation of the world's largest marine protected area in the Ross Sea, an area about the size of France and Spain combined. And finally, on the topic of cold places, if you live in the Midwest or Canada, you don't need us to tell you it's been cold. How cold? It was warmer on Mars than in Minneapolis.
According to NASA's Curiosity rover, the forecast on the red planet called for sunny conditions with a high of 28 and a low of minus 104. That high temperature was warmer than the temperatures in 38 states.
But let's emphasize that although it's been nippy out there lately, 2016 is still on track to be the hottest year on record.
So given the risk of destroying our home planet, we wondered what we should expect if we need to colonize Mars. Thanks to our friends at Universe Today, here's a few factoids.
As a rule, Mars is dry, cold, and clear. In the summer, daytime temperatures can actually warm to 70 degrees at the equator. T-shirt weather.
That same night, however, temperatures can drop to minus 130. That huge swing in one day can lead to dust storms that can engulf the entire planet.
It never rains on Mars because of its thin atmosphere and the lack of a magnetosphere, which is necessary to shield water from solar radiation. Since the sun's radiation is constantly pummeling the planet, liquid water cannot exist, therefore no need to carry your umbrella.
Occasionally, however, clouds do form and snow does fall. The Martian snowflakes, sadly, are made of carbon dioxide, so you won't need to bring your skis.
One thing to bear in mind at this time of year is that it takes 687 days for Mars to go around the sun. So Santa will only have to drop by the red planet every other year. That'll save some wear and tear on his sled and give Rudolph a break.
We hope you're taking a break and enjoying the holiday season.
Best wishes from all of us at H2O Radio, and we'll be back on January 8th. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Sustainable water management means more than just conservation. Learn about water efficiency and resilience at awwa.org/sustainable.
Senator Jeff Merkley has been appointed Chief Deputy Whip of the U.S. Senate Democratic Caucus, his office announced today. He will also join the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in the 115th Congress beginning in January. Merkley will also serve on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. In a press statement announcing the appointments, Merkley's staff dropped in a reminder that as minority leader in Oregon's House of Representatives in 2006, he engineered a Democratic takeover, becoming Oregon's first Democratic Speaker of the House in 16 years.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Lino, Ken Jones, that's me, and Rosalind Scott. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to John Alsop and Ray Bodwell. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Joe and Abe take your calls to talk about your hopes and fears for 2017. At 9 on Alternative Radio, it's a Nun on the Bus. Sister Simone Campbell, a Catholic nun and attorney who lobbies for economic justice, immigration reform, and health care. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. At 11 on Stage and Studio, Dee Mae Roberts features the final and most ambitious Imago show, La Belle, Lost in the World of Automation. At 11:30, Art Focus is off. Instead, we present Bringing Down the New Jim Crow, the formerly incarcerated and convicted people's movement. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support. Reminder that all new and increased gifts to KABU are matched one-to-one through the end of the year. Thanks to the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Go to KABU.fm and click on Donate. Good night, Ken.
Good night, Rosalyn. Good night, Danielle.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
A new idea in racial reconciliation in the United States is direct reparations. Individual people of color directly asking for what they need and white people picking up and fulfilling those requests. Organizers explain it this way, quote, "What if a stranger restored your belief in humanity, if only for a moment, by supporting you and allowing you to claim something you need in a material way?" On the website www.reparations.me, people of color register to make requests for assistance, and white allies also register with the intention of helping out. KABU's Lisa Loving spoke with founder Natasha Marin from Seattle.
Reparations.me is kind of like a interactive platform for people to make connections. So it works kind of as easily as like text messaging a friend. If you go to Facebook and you put in reparations in your search bar, an event will pop up, and it has like a little black icon, and it says, "Can we heal together?" And if you are a person of color, if you identify as a person of color, you can make offerings and requests. That can be time, energy, services, objects, money. And if you identify as white, you can make offerings and respond to those requests. So it pretty much works as though you were posting to Facebook if you're using the Facebook platform. It's like updating your status. You post an offering or request. That simple.
Does geographical location matter?
It doesn't. When I launched the project in July of this year, I launched it to my network, and my network is a global network. So we've had offerings and requests from as far away as like Zambia and New Zealand. But it is like, you know, a project that started in Seattle, and so many requested offerings are coming from the Pacific Northwest.
All right. And you just covered this a little bit briefly, but who does participate so far? Who are you finding in your network that's working with you?
The Facebook event page has about 20,000 people's worth of traffic every day, so I don't necessarily know each individual that's participating. Many of the people participating are strangers to me at this point. I think that's kind of one of the strengths of the project, is that you can connect with people outside of your immediate network. So many of us often feel like we are, in fact, preaching to the choir. You know, we're talking to our friends about how, you know, we're worried about Trump's cabinet appointments and they agree with us, or we're concerned about the incident that happened in Berlin today, and our friends are also concerned about that. But for people who are interested in making connections beyond their network, reparations is a way to connect beyond sort of your comfort zone. And really make a connection with somebody who either needs something that you can easily offer them or is offering something that perhaps you need.
All right, and that brings the question, how does the interaction between individuals have a process on our communities and beyond? Do you have a big picture on what you want to see happen here, besides sharing things, which is beautiful? I get a sense it's bigger than that, though.
Well, I think community building at its most fundamental does involve talking to people that may not be in your immediate circle of friends and family. You know, the sense of community that I think many human beings were familiar with, you know, in recent history seems to be evaporating a little bit as people feel more isolated. And, of course, technology in some ways keeps us isolated from each other. I know, like, I live in an apartment building, and I know some of my neighbors, but, you know, 50 years ago, it would be kind of bizarre to live and not know your neighbors on either side or across the street. And that's becoming the norm these days. And I think that projects like reparations do sort of remind us that what's helped us survive for eons has been our communities, actually. And that kind of no matter what we face, you know, if there was an alien invasion or a zombie apocalypse, it really would come down to your community, you know? Do you have a mechanic in your community? Do you have somebody to help look after the kids in your community? You know, do you have people who know where you can get clean water in your community? These are very much things that still are a matter of human survival that can get forgotten with all the access to technology that we have these days.
Where did this idea first come from?
I was doing what a lot of folks do on a Friday afternoon. My kids were tucked into bed, and I was scrolling my social media feed. And this summer, there were a lot of high-profile police brutality cases. There was that mass shooting in Orlando, and the news just seemed more and more tragic every single day. And what I noticed while scrolling through my feed was that people I was connected to did not feel empowered to make a difference. Many people were expressing feelings of hopelessness and just a sort of general impotence. And I thought to myself that it was kind of a cruel reality where in which people who identify as white and certainly have power and privilege that comes along with that would feel so disempowered to make a difference. Because certainly you can make a difference. Everyone can make a difference regardless of how they identify, but certainly if you can walk into the bank and get a business loan, if you can hail a cab and get a cab, if you can walk through a mall unmolested, you shouldn't be the one complaining that there's nothing you can do. So that's why I started this project, so that people who identify as white could sort of kinesthetically learn how to leverage their privilege.
It also forces white people such as myself to see and understand what people of color are going through that's different from us, maybe. That's a thing that strikes me about it. Can you name one or two of the biggest or most compelling requests from people of color that you've seen come up on this website? There have been a couple that almost made me cry.
Yeah, I mean, when you allow yourself to kind of come down from the tower of whiteness, which is really just a delusion that people continue to perpetuate. And that's a delusion of superiority. We are all actually human people of varying shades who share common ancestors in Africa. That is the truth. But the delusion of whiteness that people continue to perpetuate makes people feel like they can't understand other people's experiences. But that's ridiculous, you know? If you can read a book and sympathize with the protagonist, you can understand what another person is going through. But you do have to make the choice to allow yourself that understanding. So anyone, you know, if I tell you a story about my neighbor, and I don't tell you what my neighbor looks like, my neighbor's partner passed away 3 months ago and didn't have life insurance, didn't have savings. They have three small children. Christmas is coming up. Their electricity is about to get cut off. It's very cold. Only the most sort of desensitized human being isn't going to have sort of an instinctual response of sympathy when hearing this story. These are the kinds of stories that you hear with the Reparations Project, because many people in many places of many backgrounds are struggling right now. And they're not struggling because of some sort of failure on their own part. Life is very challenging, but for some of us, life is challenging, and we have structures that help to support us. And for others of us, life is challenging, and we don't have structures that help to support us. And so for those of us that have something to offer, it's quite actually a nice sensation to be of use to your community. I'm an artist, and people don't necessarily, you know, believe that in a post-apocalyptic world, an artist is going to come in handy as much as, say, like, an engineer, you know, or even a plumber. But what we're charged with doing as artists is having and holding vision and bringing ideas into fruition. And sometimes those ideas are controversial, sometimes they're not. But my role with this project is to remind people that we do have personal power, and we do have empathy, and we can connect with each other across divides that are often artificial, like race. Like, we already know that there is a sort of socio-political experience of race in the United States that is very real and viscerally experienced by many people. But scientifically, it's completely bogus. There's a human race, and if we were really interested in putting Starbucks on the moon, we'd be more focused on how can we work together as opposed to how can we find more ways to delineate each other and keep each other from ourselves. And I think that perpetuating this idea of whiteness is the primary way to keep people separated from each other, to have people feel isolated from the human family. And it's kind of up to white-identified people to put two and two together. You know, I can't spoon-feed everyone everything, although I'm trying.
Natasha, for weeks, as we have interviewed people working on racial issues, here on the KBOO News, we've been struck by the level of harassment activists are receiving, especially from white racists around the country. And part of your project is troll busting. Can you talk about that?